Hello, folks. Got a fundamental question for you. What will President Donald Trump mean for the public safety workplace? My name is Will Aitchison. I'm the Director of Labor Relations Information System, and I'm recording this podcast a couple of days after the November 8th election. And I figured I wanted to wait a little while to let the dust settle just a little bit. And I think a lot of people in this country are asking some pretty fundamental questions about what we're going to see in the next 4 years, not just from President Donald Trump, but also because we have a Republican House of Representatives, a Republican Senate, and we are very shortly going to get a Republican Supreme Court. What will all this mean in areas ranging from climate change to the environment to financial regulations and the like? I'm not going to focus on any of that. I'm just going to focus on the public safety workplace. And to the extent that I possibly can, to the extent that we know for sure what it is Donald Trump says he wants to do, I'm going to be relying on what he said during the course of his campaign. I know, I've been around the block. I know there is always going to be a difference between what a candidate for the presidency says and what the president actually does once he has been elected. I know there's that difference. But all we have to go on right now is what candidate Trump said, and so that's where I'm going to focus. I've got seven areas where I think you're likely to see some significant change in the public safety workplace. And let me go through them one at a time. First of all, easy pickings here, the Affordable Care Act. While he was running for office, Donald Trump's platform, and I'm quoting now from his platform that's on his webpage, is that on day one of the Trump administration, we will ask Congress to immediately deliver a full repeal of Obamacare. He has also many times in his campaign referred to the Affordable Care Act as a catastrophe. That's his words and not mine. What will that mean if he's able to accomplish that? Well, we'll see a couple of very direct impacts and then some less direct impacts. The direct impacts are a couple of the changes that were brought about by the Affordable Care Act will go away. The first is the ban on insurance companies declining coverage because of pre-existing conditions. That was a feature of the Affordable Care Act. The second is that the extension of family benefits to children who were of the age of 26 or lower, remember it used to be 21, 26 or lower, that would be repealed as well. Also, we will see such things as the Cadillac tax and other features of the Affordable Care Act no longer continue to be an issue. Now, the indirect effects are perhaps even more significant than those three direct effects. The end of the mandate for insurance and the exchange program means that people will lose health insurance. How many? Here's the range of estimates that I can find from folks that are generally pretty reliable on this sort of stuff. Estimates are that a minimum of 20 million people will lose health insurance to a minimum of 24 million people. The RAND Corporation gives us the 20 million figure. The Congressional Budget Office gives us the 24 million people. That means that the burden of providing health care to those individuals will fall back where it was before, which is on individual hospitals. And individual hospitals, of course, are not simply going to absorb those costs. They are going to pass those costs on to people who have health insurance. And you can expect to see, this is widely predicted, expect to see a substantial spike in health care rates, which of course will make health care even more of a feature of the public safety collective bargaining workplace than it is today, particularly because of what's going on with Medicare and the like. It will make retiree health care probably much more of an issue. There's also going to be, to the extent that the state of the national economy has an impact on state and local governments, and we certainly saw that when we saw the 2007 election, you can anticipate some impact from the repeal of the Affordable Care Act on general public sector economic health. The minimum estimate that I have seen is that the repeal of the Affordable Care Act will add $353 billion to the national deficit. Why? The Affordable Care Act has actually tamped down health insurance rate increases. They're much lower than they otherwise would have been. And again, I'm trying to rely on the most neutral possible sources here in giving you that information. So for that source, I'd refer you back to the Congressional Budget Office and over to outfits like the Kaiser Family Foundation that do research in this sort of area. With health insurance costs tamped down because of the Affordable Care Act, because, of course, people have this mandate to get health insurance, and the Affordable Care Act, health insurance rates go up, and the federal government is going to be paying more for health care, not just for federal government employees, but also through the Medicare and Medicaid programs. Hence, the addition of $350 billion to the deficit. I've actually seen numbers that run much, much higher than that, much more than double that. So that's the first area of impact we're likely to see. The Affordable Care Act, if it is repealed, you're going to see several impacts, I think, in the public safety, particularly bargaining workplace. Secondly, the second change you're almost certain to see is that fair share union dues will be a thing of the past. You recall that the Supreme Court was poised to overturn 38 years of its precedent and hold fair share to be an unconstitutional infringement on the free speech rights of non-members. And then one of the five members of the conservative majority of the Supreme Court, Antonin Scalia, passed away, and the court ended up with a tie vote on whether or not to hold fair share unconstitutional, which, in the context of the case that was being considered, meant that fair share continued to be a feature of labor relations. President Trump is likely to get, well, he certainly will get one appointment to the Supreme Court, be able to fill Scalia's seat. He's likely to get at least two more and maybe a third. We have three members of the Supreme Court who are close to or over 80 years old at this point in time. There seems little doubt in anybody's mind that if President Trump pulls from that list of 20 judges that he circulated during his campaign, every single one of the 20 would vote to repeal fair share. And so I think unions had better get ready to anticipate that fair share is going away. What does that mean? That means absent any changes in state collective bargaining laws, that means that individuals who are members of a bargaining unit who choose not to be a member of the union, that means those individuals have to pay nothing to the union, nothing for the costs of negotiating and administering the contract, nothing for the union's duty of fair representation with respect to those individuals. The unions will still have to consider representing non-members on disciplinary matters and other grievance matters, even though the non-members aren't paying a cent. What's that likely to produce? I think that's pretty easy to see what the developments are going to be when fair share goes away. And by the way, I'm thinking that's going to happen as quickly as within a year and maybe certainly no longer than 2 years. I think it's pretty easy to see two impacts from the end of fair share. The first is going to be that unions are going to have to start offering more benefits to their members in order to keep their members as full members, in order to keep them paying dues. Police have done that for a long time. Police have done that through legal defense funds and other sorts of benefits. It could be through disability insurance, perhaps some form of enhanced life insurance. There have been a lot of things that police have been doing. And of course, the IAFF has a huge apparatus that provides rank and file members more benefits, rank and file actual members, more benefits than a non-member would receive, access to safety databases and all of that. But it's pretty easy to see that police and fire are going to have to beef up that panoply of benefits that they offer in order to keep people in their membership. The second thing that I think is easy to predict is that unions will go to state legislatures and seek amendments to collective bargaining laws, amendments that say, we don't have a duty of fair representation for non-members, period. And there's a pretty compelling argument there, I think, that actually resonates with both Democrat and Republican politicians. Why should you be compelled to provide services if somebody is not going to pay you for those services? So I think those are the two things that you're likely to see. You will also almost certainly see, if you don't see those amendments in the state statutes that absolve the unions of their duty of fair representation for non-members, you will certainly see lawsuits by unions arguing that obliging them to represent a non-member is a taking of property without due process. You'll certainly see those constitutional lawsuits. So that's the second area. Fair share, almost certainly going to go away, probably pretty quickly, with the resultant fallout. The third area of change that I think is very predictable deals with the Fair Labor Standards Act. The one thing that I think everybody's anticipating is going to go away are those new overtime regulations that the Department of Labor finally got around to enacting earlier this year. The effective date is December 1 of this year. Those are the overtime regulations that finally, after many, many years, updated the salary test for who is exempt and who is not exempt under the FLSA, and tied that salary test in the future to changes in the cost of living. The Republicans have made that a huge priority, the repeal of those regulations. Whether they will be completely repealed or not is tough to say. It may be that they'll be repealed just for purposes of the automatic tie-in with the cost of living. Maybe they will be entirely repealed. We don't know, but it is clear that those regulations are on serious life support. A second area of change under the FLSA that I think is predictable, it will be what is anticipated with respect to the minimum wage. Unfortunately, here, when you look at what candidate Trump said, there's a bit of confusion because he said two things at different times in his campaign. At one point, he argued very strongly against any increase in the minimum wage. And his argument was that if we increase the minimum wage, we would be less competitive with foreign countries. Later in the campaign, he took a different approach and said that he wouldn't necessarily oppose an increase in the minimum wage to $10 an hour, so long as it was stepped in. And then later in his campaign, he went back to his first position. So we don't know exactly what's going to happen with the minimum wage, but I think we're likely to see some change. And while that doesn't have a direct impact on the public safety workplace, it does have an indirect impact in that the higher you increase the minimum wage, the more pressure there is on the bottom end of pay scales for public safety employees. So that's one to keep a watch out for. A third one is more subtle. Now, Donald Trump didn't say anything about this when he was running for office. To the best of my knowledge, nobody has. And this one comes down to that changing composition of the Supreme Court. And it deals with the circumstances under which public sector employees can use comp time. We have had a long-standing split around the country in the courts as to who has control over comp time usage. Is it the employer or is it the employee? The first two courts of appeals to consider the issue, one down in Texas, one in California, Fifth Circuit and Ninth Circuit, held that the employer controls comp time and can just say no for any reason or no reason at all to the employee wanting to use FLSA comp time, so long as the employee, said the Ninth Circuit, had the opportunity to use the comp time within a year of the date they wanted to use it. Two other courts of appeals, the Sixth Circuit in Ohio, the Seventh Circuit in Chicago, have held that those first two decisions are nonsense, that comp time essentially is the equivalent of money in the bank for an employee, and that the employee, not the employer, has control over comp time usage. The Bush administration, Department of Labor, in its waning days, circulated a draft regulation that sided with the employer owns comp time theory. The Obama administration, Department of Labor, quickly withdrew that draft regulation and sided with the employee controls comp time cases. I think this is an issue that has long been ripe for consideration by the Supreme Court. You just can't have the situation in the country where you have two completely different rules out there with respect to comp time usage, where whether or not you can request to use comp time and get to use the day you want depends on where in the country that you live, So I think this is one we can anticipate sometime in the next 3-4 years, seeing the Supreme Court take on. And I think a conservative Supreme Court with the types of judges that President-elect Trump has lined out as the ones he wants to appoint, I think you can anticipate they'll side with the employer controls comp time theory. But let's see on that. The fourth area where I think you'll see some change is with respect to other federal labor regulations. Candidate Trump on regulations, federal regulations, has been really clear. He thinks there should be less of them. The point that's laid out in his platform is that for every one regulation a federal agency considers, it needs to repeal two existing regulations. And federal agencies enact regulations all the time, right? They're updating numbers and they're passing regulations for everything from very substantive to completely non-substantive reasons. If President Trump does what candidate Trump suggested, we're going to see the number of federal regulations cut in half. What are the labor regulations where you're likely to see some retrenchment? And I think they're probably going to be in three areas. First of all, let's stay with the Department of Labor. The Department of Labor had a series of new regulations on the Family and Medical Leave Act that defined who a parent is and who a child is for purposes of the FMLA. Those were very controversial among employers because they expanded, some employers, they expanded FMLA benefits to children of same-sex parents and things like that. I think there's an anticipation among conservatives that those DOL regulations may be ones that should be repealed. Also over on the EEOC front, EEOC has enacted regulations in the last few years on the Americans with Disabilities Act and also on the Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act. Both of those were somewhat controversial with employers. The ADA regulations not only took the amendments to the ADA that were actually passed in 1998, took those regulation or took that those amendments, which had reversed a number of pro-employer Supreme Court decisions, it expanded the scope of the ADA in ways that even Congress had not clearly lined out. And I think employers had a lot of angst over those ADA regulations. I'll bet that you see some focus on those, on retrenching on those. And also, the EEOC has been pretty aggressive in its regulations concerning the Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act, or GINA. I think we can see EEOC taking another look at that. By the way, who's going to be running the shop in EEOC and Department of Labor? We don't know yet with respect to the EEOC, but candidate Trump made it pretty clear he wants a CEO of a large corporation to run the Department of Labor. We don't know who that is, who that could be, but is probably going to be a less labor-friendly person than we've seen. Than we've seen even under President Bush. The fifth area of change that I think you'll see also deals with federal regulations, but it's not the content of the regulations, but the enforcement of the regulations. We have seen in the last years, 8 years under the Obama administration, Department of Labor, and EEOC, we've seen some pretty aggressive enforcement, much more aggressive enforcement than we saw under President Bush. The EEOC, for example, has been very strong out there enforcing medical privacy rights for employees, looking at, for example, when fitness for duty evaluations can be given and the types of questions that can be asked with respect to fitness for duty evaluations. The EEOC has also been pretty aggressive on in defining what genetic information is under the Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act, and has come after employers for sending employees for fitness for duty evaluations where the doctors ask for family medical history. All of those regulatory efforts have been met with some opposition by employers. I think we can expect to see the EEOC go back into, I think, a fairly quiescent role with respect to the enforcement of the statutes that it administers, and which, of course, the main ones are Title VII of the Civil Rights Act, the ADA, and the Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act. I think you can also expect to see the same thing with respect to the Department of Labor. Department of Labor has been much more aggressive in enforcing the FLSA against employers. I think you can expect it to go back to the relative somnolence that it had during the Bush administration era. The sixth area of change that I think you'll see is an indirect one, and it's what's likely to happen to the National Labor Relations Board. The NLRB, particularly in the last 3-4 years, has been really aggressive and really fairly pro-labor, probably more pro-labor than we've seen in about 30 years, the EEOC has been. And you regularly see employers groups with very, very angry denunciations of the approach that the National Labor Relations Board has taken. Now, the National Labor Relations Board doesn't regulate what goes on in the public sector workplace. That's left to state and local labor boards. However, they frequently look to the NLRB for guidance. And what is the most important area where you're likely to see some change here? I think it's going to be in the circumstances under which an employer can regulate off-duty social media. That is one of the areas where the National Labor Relations Board and its general counsel has been really, really aggressive. It has taken the position repeatedly that social media is kind of the equivalent of the old-fashioned water cooler, where employees can just simply let off steam, talk about the boss, even use profanity with respect to the boss or the employer. You do that over a water cooler, you can do it over social media because it's part of communicating about wages, hours, and working conditions that is considered by the NLRB to be protected union speech. I can pretty easily foresee we are going to watch as the NLRB is reconstituted with a very conservative pro-employer majority, and I think we can anticipate that those social media changes that we saw from the National Labor Relations Board will be reversed either in substantial part or perhaps even in whole. I think another indirect impact, not as big, is going to be in the area of what's called scope of bargaining. What's negotiable? What's a wage? What's an hour? What's a working condition? And we have seen the National Labor Relations Board become more pro-labor in defining what is a mandatory subject of bargaining, what the scope of bargaining is. And I think you'll see that become more pro-employer. And I think you may see in some states, maybe not so many, a trickle-down effect with respect to their scope of bargaining cases. Where might you see the most significant impact here? Maybe with body cameras for police, because the NLRB has some pretty aggressive case law that cameras in the workplace are a mandatory subject for bargaining. We definitely see litigation all over the country now over whether body cameras are negotiable. You might see some trickle-down effect in that area. It's hard to predict pretty much anything else in terms of scope of bargaining. The last area that I want to talk is only kind of broadly a labor issue. It's not really specifically one, and it concerns the Department of Justice and its investigation of the patterns and practices of law enforcement agencies around the country as to whether or not those patterns and practices violate the civil rights of citizens. We have seen under the Obama administration the Department of Justice become the most aggressive in its history at investigating law enforcement agencies and obtaining consent decrees. It really hasn't litigated cases where it's gotten a finding of civil rights violations, but what it has done is to convince employers that it's in their best interest to enter into enforceable consent decrees. And those have brought about changes, of course, in the law enforcement workplace. I think lots of people anticipate that the Department of Justice's enforcement efforts with respect to consent decrees and the like will be reduced, and I'm being very charitable there. I actually think they'll probably almost completely go away. I think that's going to be a very likely impact given some of the things that President-elect Trump said during the course of the campaign. And then you also look at the names that are being floated for who his attorney general will be. And there's only two, mind you, I'm only 2 days out from the election when I'm recording this. But the two names that are floated are Chris Christie and Rudy Giuliani. And those names are actually being floated from inside the president-elect's transition committee. Those two individuals, I don't think, would be much interested in enforcement of consent decrees or obtaining new consent decrees or litigating over the issue of whether or not there's a civil rights violation. So those are my guesses, and they're guesses. Who knows what is going to happen as we go into what I think may be the most uncertain period of presidential politics that any of us may have seen in our lifetimes. For many years, I have used an office analogy to presidents taking office. And the office analogy that I use is, what does their inbox look like? And I have said that I thought, from my perspective, President Obama had the largest inbox, things he had to do, of any president that we've had since Franklin Roosevelt, with, of course, the Great Recession firmly in President Obama's inbox. President Trump has a pretty huge inbox, not because we have the same pressing economic considerations that we did 8 years ago, but instead because he's made all of these promises of really substantial societal change. And it's going to be, I think we're all going to be sitting back and waiting with a great deal of anticipation, either hopeful anticipation or dread, depending upon your point of view. I think we're going to be watching to see what President Trump is actually going to deliver. So with that, I'm going to be signing off. I hope you join us for our next First Thursday podcast, which will come out in early December, and hope to see you then.